This is number 0082, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there. Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0082. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, Dan Pereiro is the mind behind the great comic strip Bizarro. With his blog, he now gets immediate reaction to his cartoon work. Does that change his thought process?
Yeah, it actually does, for sure, because I get feedback and I get a quicker and better understanding of what it is about my work that people like, what kinds of ideas they react to. I feed off of the ideas that they give me. People say, you know, this reminds me of this, or I was thinking the other day of this and that really seemed like a bizarro cartoon, and you know, it's just great to climb into other people's minds.
Opera singer and Broadway star Daniel Okulich has an album coming out and an upcoming recital at Carnegie Hall. What's it like growing up in Calgary and singing opera?
I remember that when I was a boy soprano, you know, singing in Calgary. Yeah, of course, there's nothing more uncool than singing high notes when your friends are getting facial hair and you're still a boy soprano. And really, girls do not find that all that appealing. So there were a few years that were a little awkward, let's put it that way.
Stuart Nullman is in with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nullman. On this edition of Book Banter, Lori Hillenbrand tells a courageous story of Louise Zamperini in her bestseller, Unbroken. As well, I'll take a look at two of my favorite hidden stories of World War II. That's all coming up on the Stuff File program.
And we have lots and lots and lots of stuff, including an idiot of the day and a new award we're going to be giving out. We'll talk about that a little later on. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0082, is Alain Marcel, who is the chief engineer at Global News Montreal. Yes, the other place that I work at. And I thank you very much, Alain, for doing the slate on this edition of the Stuff File program. Let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Well, a woman turned a few heads when she walked into a rural Virginia courthouse with a tiny monkey clad in a pink and white dress tucked inside her bra. The woman brought the palm-sized marmoset to Amherst County Courthouse for a hearing in Juvenile and Domestic Relations Court. Officials apparently didn't notice the monkey until the woman went to an office to complete some paperwork. The woman says the marmoset is 7 weeks old and requires constant attention. The woman also said that she bought the animal at an online auction site and that its clothes are specially made in West Virginia. A monkey in her bra. Write your own punchline, folks. I'm not going near that one. Okay, I mentioned there's a new award coming up, right? I haven't decided how often I might do this, but like the idiot of the day, which comes later in the show, I might be willing to hand out another new award. I won't call it a weekly award, but we might do it occasionally. I'm thinking of calling it the Charlie Sheen Award.
You borrow my brain for 5 seconds and just be like, dude, can't handle it. Unplug this bastard, yeah.
This would be for someone who does something incredibly stupid while clearly on something. So here's our first winner of the Charlie Sheen Award.
I am on a drug. It's called Charlie Sheen.
You might say 46-year-old Tina Belinda Masta of Naples, Florida, was arrested for being a naked stoner. Quite intoxicated at the time, she allegedly sat naked on a dock near her home, throwing stones at people. When deputies arrived, they found Masta sitting on the dock, wrapped in a blanket, but she then allegedly turned toward the deputies, took off the blanket, and exposed herself to them. She had also taken some of her teeth out, and no, they weren't false teeth, and threw them into the canal. She reportedly kept picking at her teeth and asked deputies if they had some pliers she could use. After Masta was arrested, a neighbor brought out some of her clothes to the patrol car. Witnesses said Masta cursed at three men, threw rocks at them, pulled her clothes off, and then threatened to beat them up. Deputies said she reeked of alcohol.
You know, I got tiger blood, man.
Congratulations, Tina. You are the first winner of the Stuff File Charlie Sheen Award.
Wow, winning.
Carry your winnings off with pride. Elsewhere, 23-year-old Mikhail Kowalski of Gdansk, Poland, had to be rescued by the Coast Guard when he unintentionally became the world's largest vodka on the rocks. He had been drinking with some buddies when he decided to test the strength of a sheet of ice forming beside the shore. But as he climbed on, the ice broke away and carried a terrified Kowalski into the Baltic Sea by powerful currents. One friend said, "We dared him to do it, and it seemed like a good idea after a few hours of drinking." He had drifted about a mile out to sea by the time the Coast Guard caught up with him, just floating on his sheet of ice, holding his bottle of vodka. Kowalski spent the night in the hospital being treated for hypothermia, but is expected to be fine. He later told reporters, "Well, I won't be doing that again." Wow. If only Charlie Sheen could learn from his lessons.
Duh. Winning.
The world's youngest grandma is 23 years old. Yes, 23 years old. Rivka Stănescu of Romania was only 12 when she had her first child, Maria. Since the apple doesn't fall far from the tree, Maria one-upped her mom by marrying and giving birth to her first son at the age of 11. She married jeweler Ionel Stănescu. Yes, they have the same last name. That seems odd. He, by the way, is only 13. I'm just impressed at the fact that he's already a jeweler at 13. But anyway, they eloped because Rivka feared her father wanted her to marry another village boy in Investi, Romania. Up until now, the youngest known grandmother was a 26-year-old woman in Britain whose daughter gave birth in 1999 at the age of 12. So I'll just keep you posted in about a dozen years on what will surely be the youngest great-grandmother. Stay tuned. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on the program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, Senator John McCain was busy showing us just how un-tech-savvy he is during an appearance on ABC's This Week. The Arizona senator was denouncing the number of foreign-made products in the American marketplace, but praised the iPad and iPhones, which he said were made right here in America. Of course, every techie knows that they are, in fact, built in China. The iPad, iPhone, and iTouch are all products that are designed by Apple in California, but assembled in China, as is printed on the back of each and every device. If you had kept up with all the intertubes and stuff, you'd have known all of that, John. There you go. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, shall we? Dan Pereiro is the man behind the excellent comic strip Bizarro. He also has an excellent blog called, aptly enough, Bizarro Blog. We had Dan on the old radio show in the past, so it's great to have him on again. Hi, Dan.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm fine. Thanks for being on the program with us. So I recently decided to call you because I saw some of your recent drawings online, which are always fun to watch and take a look at. But you also talked about in some of your drawings the plight of your business and the fact that stuff is going out online and there's concerns about rights and concerns about issues and what people are just simply taking online. Is this a big concern of yours?
Well, it's actually sort of a big concern in the industry in general. We've had a number of conferences and seminars about it, in fact, within the cartoon industry, because people are used to being able to get things for free on the internet, and they're not willing to pay for much other than porn or actual merchandise. They're not really ready to pay for newspaper content. Yet all the newspapers are giving their content away. So all the newspapers are giving their content away for free, more or less, online. And in doing so, they're losing a lot of revenue. People are canceling their paper subscriptions and just reading it online. And then the newspaper's not getting any money for that. And then it's only matter. So these newspapers, some newspapers are folding here and there, and they're cutting things that cost them money, like cartoon strips. And so the industry is shrinking. Little by little, it's not a huge overnight catastrophe. You know, it's not a tsunami, but it's definitely a trend. It has been going on for a good 10 years now. So I spend a lot of time on my blog every day, and people really enjoy it, and I get thousands of readers, but I don't get a dime for it. You can throw ads on your blog, but that doesn't really generate much money, unless your readers are in the many millions, like Huffington Post. And then I'm also, I'm posting my cartoons on my blog, and so that But that's the common standard thing to do now. People wouldn't come to my blog if I didn't have my cartoons on there and discuss various aspects of my life and my cartoons and what I'm doing. So I'm further encouraging people to give up their newspapers inadvertently by posting everything online. So it's a peculiar thing. We're all trying to figure out a way to continue to make a living, because most cartoonists, the vast majority of cartoonists are barely get by, and even if they do get by, they certainly wouldn't if the cartoons weren't making money. They can't and won't just do it for free. I know I wouldn't. I couldn't afford to put as much effort into Bizarro as I do now if I wasn't making some kind of a living wage off of it. So yeah, it's kind of a strange time. People like me are trying to figure out a way how to make money online, because eventually that's where it's going to, what we're going to be left with.
You've been syndicated with Bizarro since 1985, so you do make a living that way.
Right.
Why is it you feel you want to have or need to have a blog? I think I know the answer to this because, I mean, I'm online myself, but why do you think you need to do that?
Well, it is a great way to connect with fans and to connect with readers. It's extremely lonely being a cartoonist because you draw, you come up with an idea, a funny idea, you draw it, you send it into a company, they print it out and send it out to all your client newspapers, and anywhere from hundreds to millions of people read it, and you never have any idea if they liked it. It's funny to tell a joke in a vacuum is kind of what cartooning is. Jokes are about reaction and laughter or appreciation of some sort. We're really performing in a vacuum. So it's great fun to have a blog where people can leave comments and you get kind of a daily contact. It also helps. It's also sort of these days it's necessary to try to promote your products, books and T-shirts or whatever. You need it also as a marketing tool. If you're not involved in technology these days, it's only a matter of time before you're forgotten completely. So, this kind of technology is as necessary for us as it is for any business person. A company without a website is pretty much just a dinosaur. Nobody cares, So we kind of have to maintain that kind of presence as well.
Well, as you mentioned, working as a cartoonist is basically working in a vacuum. You've done this cartoon for quite a while now, and now you have this online presence. Now that you have the immediate response from your fans, does it change the way you work as a cartoonist or even your thought processes?
Yeah, it actually does, for sure, because I get feedback and I get a quicker and better understanding of what it is about my work that people like, what kinds of ideas they react to. I feed off of the ideas that they give me. People say, this reminds me of this, or I was thinking the other day of this, and it really seemed like a Bizarro cartoon, and, it's just great to climb into other people's minds, because cartoonists typically don't have a team of writers behind them the way, say, a television talk show host. We have to do something. We have to do our work every single day, just like Jay Leno and Conan O'Brien, but we don't have a team of writers to help us keep track of what's going on in the world and make all these jokes. So it's nice to get that feedback. It's really nice to climb into other people's point of view and mind and stuff, and it's... It kind of frees me up to think in different directions that I might not have thought before. In the old days, when I first started, I've been doing it, 20,000 years now, I think. let's see, 85, 95, one of my, so it's been like 26 years. It's showing off my math skills. For the first 15 years or so, for the first 10 years, I didn't even have email. It just wasn't a common thing back then. So I had no contact other than the occasional person who would think to write and snail mail me a letter or something. So there, I had no feel for what it was about my work that people were responding to or liking or disliking.
The difference between today and back then is there were many steps to get in contact with you. Like you say, somebody had to write something down, put it in an envelope, put a stamp on it, and go to the mailbox. Now it's almost instantaneous, and there's also in 2011 a little bit of a lack of civility. The upside is you get to hear from your fans. The downside is people can complain about what you do without really thinking. I've looked at some of the complaints you had and the responses you've had to some people. Does that sometimes annoy you, let's say?
In a minor way. I've been doing it so long now that I'm really very used to it. And I'm not a terribly controversial cartoonist. I'm not an editorial cartoonist. You know, politics is what gets people really fired up. So I don't get a ton of negative mail, but the negative mail I get, for the most part, it falls into two categories. It's a misunderstanding where they thought that I was criticizing some group or some situation that I wasn't really intending to criticize. In which case, a friendly apology is all that they're looking for, and they're happy. And the other is it's just complete crackpots who totally go off on some weird tangent that they and they alone saw in this cartoon. And those actually I find really entertaining. Those are the ones that I typically will share on my blog. And I still most often will write a polite response back to people and explain to them that I didn't intend to offend them in this way. But, some of them are just... So anyway, they don't... the misunderstandings don't bother me so much, and the craziness is actually entertaining. I don't actually mind it too much. I sort of enjoy that immediate feedback. It gives me a good idea of what's going on out there in people's minds.
Just the title of your comic strip, Bizarro, I mean, to put that out every day, do you see things differently in your mind's eye? I mean, is everything you see on a daily basis when you're walking down the street or whatever you're doing a bizarro moment in some way, shape, or form?
Well, it certainly can be. I don't typically get ideas when I'm out walking around. I just sit down and write ideas early in the morning when my mind is still relatively fresh and blank. But on the other hand, I have, since I was a little kid, I've always had an objective, sort of a naturally objective point of view on the world. And even when I was a child, I would, in my mind at least, I would question all the things that I was told and all the things that I was taught and all the things that I saw going on around me. I remember being very young and wondering why in the world. I was raised in Oklahoma, and in the summertime it would be 100 degrees out, and I saw my dad putting on a coat and a tie, an entire suit, to go to work. And I remember thinking, why would you wear a coat and a scarf when it's 100 degrees outside? So these are just like simple little things that I've always kind of done in my head. And that's the genesis of my jokes, is just sort of looking at average everyday life and figuring out what's wrong with this picture, and portraying it in a way that sort of both surprises people and that they recognize in their own world in some way or another.
Well, we certainly do enjoy the work that you do, and I also want to mention very quickly that you do travel with your one-man show, the Bizarro Baloney Show. Are you still doing that?
I do it from time to time. I do it when asked, and if the invitation is attractive enough, if it's somewhere I want to go, and it gives me enough money to actually do it and put a big kink in my deadline schedule, then I will. But I don't actually tour it regularly, but I do it several times each year in different places when people ask me. Yeah, it's a lot of fun. That's another really great way to interact with my readers on a second-to-second basis. You know, to actually be able to show a cartoon, tell a joke, and hear the laughter is terrific. It's something cartoonists never get.
And people can get a chance to see your blog where?
Well, it's at bizarrocomics.com.
Bizarrocomics.com. And when people go there, don't forget to maybe drop a few shekels into the tip jar.
Yeah, absolutely. It helps pay for the blog time.
I thank you very much, Dan, for taking the time to talk with us.
All right, I enjoyed it. Thank you.
Dan Pereiro of Bizarro Comics fame. Again, you can check out his website at bizarrocomics.com, and you can go to my website at thestufffile.com, click on the Stuff File program, and then the episode number for this show, which is show number 0082, and you'll find links to Dan's website.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of the Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
Coming to you from Canada, the land of universal healthcare, colorful money, and the correct spelling of the word theater. This is The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to Daniel Okulich, a Broadway and opera star, plus we'll hear some of his new album. And we'll also check in with Stuart Nullman and another edition of Book Banter. Plus, we have an Idiot of the Day, and this is a special Idiot of the Day coming up, by the way. It's an audio version of Idiot of the Day. Stay tuned for that. But right now, more stuff here on The Stuff File program. And apparently not everything that happens in Vegas stays in Vegas, so I guess that old adage is now wrong. Lauren Serafin and Robert Layton were supposed to get married last August, but then Robert had himself a big old bachelor party in Vegas and apparently hooked up with a woman he met on the trip. Lauren discovered all of this after she found some text messages on Robert's cell phone, because he was too stupid to delete them, detailing the illicit rendezvous. So not only did she promptly break off their relationship, she's now suing him for $62,814, the exact amount she says she has already spent preparing for the wedding and the honeymoon. She would, of course, know all the legal ins and outs because Lauren just happens to be an attorney. The lawsuit alleges breach of the promise to marry and intentional infliction of emotional distress, claiming that, quote, the defendant had a fiduciary duty of implied fidelity to the plaintiff, unquote, and that the plaintiff suffered humiliation by having to tell family members, friends, and co-workers that the wedding was canceled and why. Paging Bob Dorigo Jones, paging Bob Dorigo Jones. Oh, that comes up later on the Let's Be Fair segment. Stick around. More lawsuits to come. Elsewhere, 57-year-old Linda Rose Gagna of Tustin, California, has guaranteed herself some serious misery in the afterlife. Hard to get through the pearly gates when you swindle a group of nuns out of $285,000. Wow. Gagna surrendered to the FBI after being indicted for wire fraud in the alleged scam. She ran a company that said aided clients with real estate transactions and allegedly pocketed money sent to her by the sisters from the province of the Religious of Jesus and Mary based in Rhode Island. Gagna, who had once attended a boarding school run by the order, allegedly visited the Rhode Island convent and learned they were interested in purchasing a piece of property in San Diego for use as a residence for some of the sisters. Now, prosecutors said Gagna offered to help with the deal despite not having a California real estate license. Then, using an allegedly false letter from an attorney, Gagna allegedly convinced the sisters to send her $285,000 from their retirement fund to purchase the property from a bank. The funds allegedly instead went into her pocket. She faces 60 years if found guilty. And then, of course, there's always hell to look forward to after that because, seriously, how do you sleep at night knowing you've ripped off nuns? Wow. She went to a boarding school with nuns? Did they not teach her anything? Okay, moving right along. Just listen to this quote and you can pretty much figure out where this story is going. Here we go. I was trying to tie the gun around my leg. Okay, you know what happened, didn't you? That's what an Orlando, Florida teen told police after allegedly shooting himself in the testicles with a 9mm pistol. Ouch! All the guys listening to this are now crossing their legs. According to police, the unidentified teenager was lying in bed watching TV with his sister. Apparently, while trying to strap the gun to his leg, it went off, sending a bullet through his scrotum and into his upper thigh. His sister called 911 and he was taken by ambulance to the Winnie Palmer Hospital for Women and Babies. Wow, it must be embarrassing being a teen boy, acting all macho with a gun and all, shooting Jim and the twins, and then being taken to the Winnie Palmer Hospital for Women and Babies. Seriously, nice name for a hospital. Enjoy sharing that story at school. And finally, in this section of the Stuff File News with me, Peter Anthony Holder, before we get to our next guest. In Yuma, Arizona, a stray dog darted into an Arizona apartment and decided his new hangout would be inside the refrigerator. The family told firefighters the pooch rushed into their home when they opened the front door and kept snapping at them. When they went to the fridge to get some food to try to lure the dog outside, the animal jumped into the fridge and refused to come out. Firefighters found the small black terrier-type dog crouched on the bottom shelf. I guess that's right around the crisper, right? Snapping at anyone who approached. They used protective gear to pick up the pooch and put it in a carrier. The dog had been reported missing by someone else at the apartment complex and was returned home safely. Okay, that's not normal dog behavior. Has anybody thought to check out the family the dog came from before they just handed it back over to them? An investigation is warranted here, don't you think? Anyway, let's get to our next guest on the Stuff File program, shall we? Something musically inclined to get past that dog story. Daniel Okulich has gone from Calgary to Broadway. He first garnered attention on The Great White Way in Baz Luhrmann's production of La Boheme. He's currently preparing for a recital at Carnegie Hall, and he's also working on a solo album. He's very busy, but he joins us on the line right now. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for being on the program with us. So it's
my pleasure.
Quite the journey you've taken from, as I mentioned, Calgary to Broadway. How did this happen for you?
That journey itself, I mean, there's always a lot of intermediary steps which we gloss over. I ended up going to school in the U.S., the Oberlin Conservatory of Music and then the Cincinnati Conservatory. The actual trip to Broadway was kind of a fluke. It was good timing. I auditioned for Baz Luhrmann's production back when I was just finishing up my artist diploma in Cincinnati, and after about four different callbacks, they decided that they were going to put me in the original cast. And yes, we did, 7.5 months on Broadway? We did a run in L.A., and that really kind of started my career. It got me to New York, it got me an agent, it got me a little bit of exposure, but since then, I've just been building a more standard, I guess, opera career with regional and international companies. So for me, it was just a really fortunate first step.
Well, what was your initial goal when you went out to go to school? What did you see your career as being, and did you think Broadway was going to be a part of it?
I can't say that I thought it was. I never discounted it, because when I was younger, that was my goal. Before I started training in opera, I thought that I came of age when Les Mis and Phantom were, you know, at the peak of their popularity, and those were holy writ to me when I was a when I was a teenager. But then my taste changed, and my training changed, because my voice was maybe more suited for opera. But I grew up with that. I would do musical theater classes. I would sing a lot of it, and I still love it. But it was, in terms of how I saw my career panning out, truthfully, I when you're in school, you just hope that you're going to work. You know, you learn that there are many paths to have a career, but you just really hope that you're going to be able to do it at all, because the statistics are so low that anyone gets to do this career.
When it comes to opera, some people maintain that it's, shall we say, an acquired taste. Growing up in Calgary, wanting to sing opera, did that make you, not necessarily an outcast, but off the beaten path, as it were?
Oh, you can say outcast. It's all right. The funny thing is, I mean, there was an old joke when we were growing up with my teacher in Calgary. She said, you know, there's two types of music in Calgary, there's country and there's Western. So it wasn't exactly a standard thing. But truthfully, I didn't grow up wanting to do opera. I didn't like wake up one day when I was 8 or 9 years old and decide I wanted to be an opera singer. I just liked singing. And I had a little community teacher for a time who, you know, had me singing Disney songs and little art songs, and then graduated into a teacher at a higher level who had me doing small opera arias and more art song in different languages, and just kind of nudged me towards that. But it wasn't until really late high school that I thought that I might try to make a career of it. I remember that when I was a boy soprano, you know, singing in Calgary, yeah, of course, there's nothing more uncool than singing high notes when your friends are getting facial hair and you're still a boy soprano. And then really, girls do not find that all that appealing. So there were a few years that were a little awkward, let's put it that way.
Okay, so let's flash forward. You've done La Boheme. You are a bass baritone. You have not only an album coming out, but you have a recital coming out or taking place the same day.
Yeah, we've kind of timed it that way. It's essentially the album is the recital. We're recording all the tracks now. We're in the throes of doing that. But the actual program will be exactly what's on the CD. So if they enjoy the recital, then hopefully that's a built-in group of people who will buy it. But it's a nice way to for 2 months straight, I'm working on the same repertoire of all this these fantastic American composers.
How did you go about choosing the songs for this particular recital and album? And also, I understand you worked with a very interesting collection of composers.
Yeah, the whole idea for the album came about from Glenn Rovin, initially, who contacted me kind of out of the blue over a year and a half ago, come to think of it, and sent me some of his pieces and said we should meet up and go over them when I was in New York. And at first, I didn't really give him much of a second thought, and then we started going through them when I was in New York, and I really kind of enjoyed them. And he said he wanted to do an album, and what kind of an album did I want to do? And we decided on an album of contemporary American art songs, and then the next process, of course, was choosing the composers. And J.K. Yee is a friend of mine whose work I really enjoy. Ricky Ian Gordon is someone whose work I've admired. And then Glenn also suggested Lowell Lieberman, whose work I wasn't familiar with. So for each of them, it was a process of them sending me pieces, or in the case of Ricky, we sat down at his apartment here in New York and just played through, I don't know how many pieces, before we decided on a set. And the process was really, he would play something, he said, listen, if you like it, if you have an emotional response to it, let's put it aside in a yes or maybe pile, and if you don't, then no harm, no foul, we'll just put it in a different pile. And by the end of it, we had probably 12 to 15 pieces, and we pared it down to about 8 or 9. And it turned out that this cycle was kind of, the pieces had a thematic link, and there were things that I could relate to that were slightly autobiographical. So that was a lot of fun, and we made a cycle out of those. And Jake submitted a bunch of his pieces to me as well, and I went through them. And it's in the end, you go with what moves you and what you really want to sing. And so each one of these pieces, I have the luxury of being able to say that I absolutely want to sing them, and they're something that I respond to very, very viscerally in all of them.
What is it exactly that is your decision-making process when you decide to pick a song that you want to sing? Does it have to fit within a range or an emotion for you? In other words, to make you want to sing it for an album, per se?
Yes and no. The good thing is everyone involved in this, they were perfectly fine with transposing pieces that they had to suit my voice. And so the range is always something that, that is totally suitable for me. And otherwise, it's not that there's a mood that it has to have. I just have to like it. I have to hear it and think, oh, I would like to sing that song. Or I enjoy listening to it. I'd like to hear other people do it. I guess I'll take on the responsibility. it's kind of an intangible thing. And why does anyone like or respond emotionally to a particular song? Sometimes it's the poem, frankly. The words move me in a very particular way, and I feel a calling to sing them. So I can't say that it's ever one thing. There's pieces that are in this entire recital which are completely different from one another. Some are very serious and grand. Some are kind of pathetic. Some are rapturous and joyful and silly. But I get a chance to explore all of those, which is kind of nice.
You're doing this concert on March 28th, which is also the same date as the album release. It's a concert where you're singing the songs from this particular album. Is it different performing on stage as Daniel Okulich as opposed to singing on stage within a character?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's, to be honest, recital work hasn't been something I've done a whole lot of. I did one in February 2009 back in Canada, and that was the first one I had done in I don't know how many years. It was actually kind of stressful because when you're not accustomed to it, you feel very exposed. There's no staging to hide behind or costuming or sets. And even in the largest role in opera, you get to go off stage and let someone else take the reins for a little while. But a recital, it's all you, and your mental focus and your ability to hold an audience is really on the line. So I like to think that I can still immerse myself in the character of these pieces, and that offers a certain amount of safety, but it's a pretty thin net, and it's a different challenge. But you know, if you don't challenge yourself, you're going to become stagnant. So I figure I better put myself out there in something I'm not 100% comfortable with.
The name of the show, by the way, is The New American Art Song, and I trust that's also the title of the album.
Yes, it is. As a matter of fact.
And the show takes place at Carnegie Hall on March 28th. Album was released on the same day as well, correct?
That is correct, at Weill Hall in Carnegie.
Excellent. I thank you very much, Daniel, for taking the time to be on the program with us.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Bass baritone Daniel Okulich, who will be performing at Weill Hall at Carnegie on March 28th. His new album is also released on that day. Here's a little taste of it now.
Earth has not anything to show me. Dull would be a soul who could pass by a sight so touching in its majesty. A city now dark like a current where the beauty of the morning silent bear. Ships, towers, tombs, theatres, and to the fields and to the sky, all bright and glittering in the smokeless air. Never did a sun more beautifully steep in his first splendor valley, rock, or hill. As for I never felt a calm so deep. The river glideth at his own sweet will. Dear God, the very houses seem asleep, and all that mighty heart is lying still.
Yeah.
Daniel O'Coolidge. The album is called The New American Art Song. You can get the CD by going to gprrecords.com. That's gprrecords.com. And you can visit my website at thestufffile.com, click on the Stuff File program, and then go to the episode number for this show, which is show number 0082, and you can find links to Daniel's website and also to gprrecords.com, where you can order the CD directly. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Have you ever heard of Lloyd's of London? It's a British underwriter known for insuring things no one else will cover. Over the years, Lloyd's has insured things like Tina Turner's legs, satellites launched into space, and even the hair of Pittsburgh Steelers football star Troy Polamalu. Lloyd's of London has been around since the 17th century and will insure these unusual things because it understands risk as well as anyone. Knowing this, I was very disappointed to learn recently that Lloyd's believes the worst place in the world to practice medicine because of the risk of being sued is right here in America. The president of our nation's largest private medical school told me that Lloyd's has called Philadelphia the worst place on earth to practice medicine because of its terrible medical liability climate. Let's be fair, Philadelphia's legal system is clogged with lawsuits, but it isn't even the only place in America doctors avoid because of the high risk of being sued. It's putting healthcare out of reach for many Americans. Learn how it's affecting you. Go to our website at centerforamerica.org.
What are they saying about If the Rains Don't Cleanse? New York Times bestselling author David Mixner says, as a writer and advocate for Africa, I could not put down Ben Patrick Johnson's If the Rains Don't Cleanse. Aubrey Hooks, the U.S. ambassador to Ivory Coast, says, fascinating and hard to put down. If the Rains Don't Cleanse is CNN breaking news disguised as historical fiction. If people can't put it down, then why haven't you picked it up? If the Rains Don't Cleanse, the tale of missionaries in 1950s Belgian Congo is loosely based on my own parents' lives. It's available online, including Amazon.com and Amazon.ca. I, Ben Patrick Johnson, want you to read this book. My mother, Avidale Johnson, wants you to read this book. Now remember, this is a woman who survived as a missionary in Congo half a century ago. She is tough. Now do not make me send her your way. If the Rains Don't Cleanse, get it now, or deal with my mother.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of the Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands, just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nullman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And we do indeed have Stuart Nullman. It's another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program. Hi, Stu.
Hi, Peter, and I salute you with all the military respect that one would give way back about 70 years ago.
If I were in the military.
If you were in the military, and if I was in the military, I salute you. You can't see it now, but yes, I am saluting you.
And you're doing this because?
Because I got a World War II book, actually.
Ah.
It's a book called Unbroken. You know, one thing, it's by Laura Hillebrand. And one thing you can say about Laura Hillebrand, she can take a story that very few know about and turn it into a story that everyone will start talking about. And that was the case with the number one New York Times bestseller, Seabiscuit, which was published 10 years ago, which told the story about the Depression-era champion racehorse of the same name, which brought the horse and its fascinating story to almost legendary proportions. And now Louis Zamperini, a Championship American Olympic runner and World War II airman, is getting the Hillebrand treatment, and the results are just as fascinating in her latest book called Unbroken, which has been topping the bestseller list across North America for the past few months. It talks about Louis Zamperini, who's the focal point of this story. He established a reputation as a solid track and field athlete when he was at USC with a wealth of awards to prove it. A hardworking and determined athlete, he earned his spot on the U.S. Olympic track team for the 1936 Berlin Olympics the hard way, ran in blazing heat in the Olympic trials in New York City. Although he didn't win any medals in Berlin, he was touted as a medal hopeful at the 1940 Games in Tokyo. However, the outbreak of World War II and the subsequent Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor quashed his Olympian ambitions. He enlisted in the Army Air Force, became a lieutenant, and served as a bombardier for a B-24 Liberator bomber in the Pacific Theater of the War. And he survived quite a lot of harrowing attacks and bombing missions. But somehow his luck changed dramatically in May of 1943 when, during a search and rescue mission somewhere in the over the middle of the Pacific Ocean, the B-24 plane he was flying crashed into the ocean, in which Zamperini and three other crewmen emerged as the sole survivors. So with very little or no prospect of rescue, Zamperini and the other three members withstood 54 days of pure hell afloat on a small inflatable raft with practically no food or drinkable water and man-eating sharks constantly swimming around the raft waiting to feast upon its human prey. So they get rescued, but not by friendly rescuers, but by the enemy, the Japanese. And Louis held in a series of detention and POW camps in Japan, and he's subject to some of the worst brutality at the hands of his Japanese captors, particularly one NCO named Mutsuhiro Watanabe, or the Bird, as his fellow prisoners sort of affectionately refer to him as. Basically, Watanabe personified the worst traits of Japanese prisoner of war camp military personnel during the Pacific, and used Zamperini as his personal punching bag, subjecting him to the most inhumane beatings for even the most minor of offenses, which would normally kill any mortal human being. But Unbroken is three stories in one, and each one becomes more and more compelling as the book progresses. Hillenbrand has done an excellent job telling the story of Louis Zamperini and his harsh ordeal in the Pacific, and through a great deal of courage and resilience, didn't allow his Japanese captors to gain that total victory over him. As well, there's a great wealth of research that's done in the book to tell the mainly hidden story of the difficulties Allied POWs went through in the Pacific. We find out how the B-24 Liberator bomber was a virtual death trap for its U.S. Air Force crews. In fact, many airmen were killed in training runs in actual combat. And for POWs held captive in Japan-based prison camps, they were pretty well kept in the dark about the Japanese surrender in August 1945, just days before the Japanese were supposed to carry out an unheard-of order to murder every single POW that they held before the Allied troops arrived. But Unbroken is a shocking, inspiring story of sheer survival in the most dangerous of situations, and will certainly shed light on the hidden story of the Pacific Theater, and make Louis Zamperini one of the most revered yet somewhat reluctant heroes of that aspect of the war, and was probably one of the biggest races of his life.
It's interesting how we're hearing more about the Pacific side of World War II with HBO's The Pacific and now this, because so much has been said and written about what took place, of course, in the European theater.
Oh, exactly. It was almost like the unhidden aspect of World War II is more of, more attention was paid to the to the European theater of World War II, and thanks to the Tom Hanks, Steven Spielberg miniseries and re-releasing of some books about the Pacific campaign, they're getting their just due, actually. There's a couple of books I must recommend, speaking of that. One is Band of Brothers, by Stephen Ambrose, which was also the basis of an excellent HBO miniseries. And also, another hidden story about the Pacific Theater was, it's called Ghost Soldiers by Hampton Sides, about a rescue mission that a group of American commandos did to rescue some American POWs that were, faced certain death at the hands of their Japanese captors. That was also a movie, too, actually. So I do recommend Ghost Soldiers by Hampton Sides as well. So excellent reading.
And how do people find you, sir?
Well, they can go to www.westendtimes.ca and look at my Book Banter column online.
Excellent. Thank you very much, sir.
You're welcome, Peter.
Stuart Nelman and Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're almost done with this edition of The Stuff File program, but we do have an idiot of the day, a special audio idiot of the day coming up in just a matter of moments. But before we get to that, one more Stuff File news story for you. When a man allegedly tried to rob a convenience store in Gastonia, North Carolina, a surveillance camera got it all. It showed the man drive up to the store, get out, and start rifling through a dumpster. He emerged with a paper bag, which he took into the store while wearing what looked like a ski mask that had been put on the wrong way. As he entered the store, he dropped the bag and stumbled as he tried to pick it up. The store clerk, Guillermo Troncoso, said the man asked for money. Now, Troncoso thought he was joking because of the ridiculous way he was wearing the mask. So the robber showed him a gun, but when the clerk didn't seem daunted by it, the robber put the gun down on the counter so that he could grab the cash register. The clerk pulled it back by its electric cord, and both the robber and the register fell down on the floor. Of course, Troncoso had already grabbed the gun off the counter, as well as a baseball bat. Troncoso jumped up on the counter and started hitting the robber in the head with the bat, sending him running out of the store, but he slipped and fell, trying to get into his car. Troncoso managed to get in one last good hit as he smashed out the back window of the car before it got away. His description of that damage helped police to track down the suspect, and Randall Scott Strait, age 47, was charged with attempted armed robbery. They need to add a new charge, armed and stupid. And as dumb as that is, as silly as that was, he didn't make it to the idiot of the day, because we have a classic, and it's an audio idiot of the day, and it's right now.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This Stuff File presents the idiot of the day.
Timothy Chappick broke into a Portland, Oregon home on the evening of March the 8th and was taking a shower when he heard the owner arrive. Afraid that the owner might have a gun, Chappick called 911 and told the befuddled operator what was going on. Moments later, the owner of the house also called 911 on her cell phone to report Chappick, whom she questioned as to why he was at her home. Now this, as I said, is a special audio idiot of the day because hearing the 911 call is believing. The only thing I've added is the appropriate music. Enjoy.
911. I just broke into a house, and the owner came home.
You broke into a house?
Yeah.
Where at?
I don't know.
Okay, so are you still there?
Yeah.
Okay, so are you...
I think that's good.
Okay, where are you?
I don't know.
You have no clue where you are?
No.
Where are you in the house?
I'm up in the hills.
Where are you in the house?
They can hear me.
Okay, what's your name? What's your name? Why do you think they have guns?
Kidnap.
Hello?
I'm sorry. My name is Timothy Chappick. I broke in. I was kidnapped. I've already called them. They're on the phone right now. She'll call the police.
Yes. Chappick was arrested on first-degree criminal trespassing, held in county jail for a while, and then released. But, oh, it gets better. He's been rearrested. Soon after his first release, officers found him loading stolen property into a vehicle at a Walmart store after midnight. Yes, everything happens at Walmart. Police said they ran a check and found that Chappick was wanted on warrants out of Oregon. In addition, the vehicle he was using had just been stolen from an Oregon car dealership. But let's back up. Why would he break into someone's house to take a shower only to call the cops on himself? One reason, and one reason only, he's an idiot.
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0082. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and again, that's 0082. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com, and you can find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder. Don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, aboard China Airlines, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. A tape of the preceding program will be sent to the Radio Hall of Fame, where it will be placed under the statue of Marconi, which is kind of wobbly.